Steve, you are so Jewish. Make me pay the bill every time. Well, it's great to be back here with you. Boy, everybody's writing these doomsday books about 2012. They're making movies, thinking the whole world's going to come to an end when the long count Mayan calendar ends on December 21st. But what about 2011? Seems like a pretty active year to me thus far. A lot going on presently. Well, I've been asked to speak about the future of the Middle East and Bible prophecy. You know, the world has got a watchful eye as the Arabs are protesting and the governments are collapsing over there and the radical regimes are rising in Israel. It's extremely isolated and insecure presently. This can't be good for them. So we'll be talking about that in this session. Well, when it comes to speaking about the future of the Middle East and Bible prophecy, there is a whole lot to be discussed. There's a lot of things going on, and so I'm going to, right out the gate, defer you to the book that I cut my teeth on from Dr. Arnold Fruchtebaum called The Footsteps of the Messiah. This is my prophecy Bible. I have it with me whenever I do radio interviews. You know, it sequences all the events. He does a great job. You can probably actually get some out in the foyer. He talks about the Israeli war prophecies, and I'll be speaking about Psalm 83 tonight and a little bit about Ezekiel 38. The future of Israel, the future of the Arab states in Bible prophecy, the third Jewish temple, Antichrist, false covenant, the two witnesses, the abomination of desolation, and the eight stages of Armageddon, and so on and so forth. It's just really a spectacular book. And since he does such a good job on that, I'm going to confine my talk tonight on the near future of the Middle East of Bible prophecy, which is on my radar screen, which I'm watching for to happen biblically, perhaps the next prophetic headline in the Middle East. I talk about the Middle East going apocalyptic quite a bit when I go out to these prophecy conferences. In fact, I recently spoke at a church, Calvary Chapel, Huntington Beach, and my friend Mike Harris, the pastor there, was concerned I might go apocalyptic, so he did this little image of me like this, and he showed that in front of his whole congregation before I got up there and spoke in Huntington Beach. But obviously I'm not a terrorist. I haven't been able to sport a beard like that since I graduated from high school in 1971. But speaking of terror, of course, that's a very important subject, and since these Arab unrests have been going on, the Department of Homeland Security has raised the terror level to the highest level it's been since September 11th. We're at orange right now, and that this terror meters came out, the terror color code came out with Tom Ridge, who became the first Department of Homeland Security. He came out with this terror meter, and it really caught on, and it started permeating the whole country on the billboards, and then the next thing you know, you saw it at the airports, and then they started making terror meters and terror mugs, and it was just taking over the whole country, and finally someone came up with a terror security blanket. For those people that were insomniacs, they just couldn't quite deal with it all. I haven't got one of these. I sleep quite well, but if they are available. And then they wanted to indoctrinate the kids, so they started coming up with terror meter spinners. You could play Twister and games like that. And then they got it going in Sesame Street, Elmo, and then in The Simpsons, so the kids could get it. It was getting quite overwhelming, and of course the politicians got involved. And the Republicans came out in 2008 when the Democrats, Obama won, and they took control of the Congress, and they raised their meter up to red for severe. But then in the midterm elections of 2010, the Democrats came out with their own because they're very concerned now that there's so many Republicans. And if you're a Republican, that's fine. If you're involved in the Tea Party, it gets a little nerve-wracking for them. But if you're a Glenn Beck listener and you're a Republican, you are off the charts on their thing. Of course, terrorism is not just confined to America anymore. It's an international problem. The UK came out with their one, and they're very similar to ours, but they use little different codes. Critical is red versus severe. My favorite is the one the French came out with. If the French experience terrorism on their land, they run, hide, surrender, or just simply collaborate it when it gets too bad. So, anyway, with that all said, Janice Napolitano, who's head of the Department of Homeland Security these days, will probably discard these terror codes pretty soon because of once the findings are released of a recent study that just came out regarding the origin of the 72 versions of jihad, a study's been done, and it turns out, you know, the Jihad is when he perpetrates an attack, a terrorist attack. He believes when he's done, he gets to go up and be united with 72 Islamic female virgins. Well, what they found out is it's the same 72, and they date back 1,300 years to the time of Muhammad. So, need I say anymore, they haven't been virgins since the 7th century. But that's definitely going to hamper Al-Qaeda's attempt to recruit, so we'll see where that goes. If you have your Bibles with you, you turn to Genesis 16. And we're going to read verse 11 and 12 to start the talk today. Now the angel of the Lord is talking to Hagar, the mother of Ishmael. And he says to her, "Behold, you are with child, and you shall bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has heard your affliction. He shall be a wild man. His hand shall be against every man, and every man's hand against him, and he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren." And we are also told in Genesis 20 that Ishmael, the son of Hagar, would be a great nation. Ishmael is the father of the Arabs. He's pretty much known that way. And the great nation, probably out of his loins, is for the most part would be Saudi Arabia, of which I will be speaking about a little bit tonight, about some of their fate in the future. It's interesting, in verse 11, the angel of the Lord tells Hagar that she's going to have a son. Now, how would he know that? Did he have a sonogram? It's a 50-50 shot. It could have been a girl. So the Lord knows the beginning from the end, and he knew that this would happen, and that her son Ishmael, the father of the Arabs, would have a bunch of violence inside of his household, and Arabs would be fighting against each other throughout time, and they have been. And the unrest over there is characteristic of Arab behavior. Arabs have fought against Arabs more than Arabs have fought against Jews throughout their history. So we shouldn't be surprised to see this unrest that's going on over in the Middle East presently. Speaking of which, let's talk about the Middle East mayhem that's going on over there presently. If you've been watching your news, you know it's really quite volatile over there. Let's start with Iraq. We pulled out after being in a war over there since 2003. We pulled out. We still have a few troops over there. We pulled out in the summer of last year. And on January 5th, Muqtada al-Sadr, a Shiite cleric from Iraq, went into self-imposed exile when we were over there, the American troops, into Iran. Well, now he's come back on January 5th of this year. And he's hooked up with Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri Maliki to form a pro-Iranian government. So that happened on January 5th. Alarmed King Abdullah of Jordan, who called Benjamin Netanyahu and said, "Watch out, Iran is trying to form a Shiite crescent." He's been warning about that since 2004. A Shiite crescent in the Fertile Crescent from Tehran through Lebanon, Beirut, through Damascus, Syria, on through Baghdad, on through Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is very concerned. That was on January 5th. January 13th, we travel over to Lebanon. Hezbollah had 10 of its cabinet members, and they convinced another cabinet member, 11 cabinet members, to step out of the Lebanese parliament, thus collapsing the Lebanese government. That was on January 13th. Then, of course, Tunisia on January 15th had their Arab unrest. And, of course, Tunisian President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali has stepped down. It's the first time in Arab history that a dictator was overthrown by a popular revolution. So that started. Then you had Egypt come along on February 11th. I'm sure you watched that. That was a bloody mess in those streets. Mubarak has since stepped down. That was an 18-day protest, and now Egypt is in a state of flux presently. If you were here yesterday, I had mentioned that WorldNet Daily wrote an article, Aaron Klein over there, that Egyptian leadership, although it's still formulating presently, is already in conversations with Hamas, trying to build stronger alliances with Hamas, and they also want to do that so that the Hamas and the Fatah of Mahmoud Abbas's fame would come together, because they have strife amongst them. Now, Hamas, I'll be going over their charter with you a little bit later, they do seek the destruction of Israel through jihad. So that's Egypt. That was quite a mess. You saw that. And then you had Yemen, Algeria, and Jordan. They all started getting concerned about protests that was going on. Yemen has still got protests going on. Jordan, on February 1st, sacked its government, King Abdullah. He was very concerned to try to prevent protests. On February 3rd, King Abdullah of Jordan met with the Muslim Brotherhood. And he's met with them again a time or two since. So King Abdullah of Jordan is very concerned about what's going on over there, meeting with the wrong crowds. And he did say, by the way, last year, that the peace treaty he has with Israel that his father formed in 1994, he has said that Jordan was better off economically before that peace treaty was made. So that was a quote from him last year. So how long the peace treaty between Israel and Jordan will remain intact is questionable. It's iffy. Well, it didn't stop there. It moved over to Bahrain on February 15th. Bahrain is ruled by a Sunni minority. It's a very wealthy nation, very rich oil-producing nation. And there's a Shiite majority over there. And they are protesting. And they're actually, again today, marching towards the capital today. This is still going on since February 15th. It's a big deal. Iran, they're concerned that Iran, which is predominantly Shiite, is trying to muscle in on Bahrain right now. Saudi Arabia is very concerned about this. They've sent over tanks. I think they sent over about 50 tanks about 10 days ago or 2 weeks ago. And they're watching this very closely, the activity over there. And, of course, Libya, you see them up there. Well, Muammar Gaddafi is just, you know, having his way with his people over there. And the Arab League stepped up today and said, we need to do something about this because the international community is saying, you should get involved here. This is not good. See, the Arab League is trying to, it's a 22-member association, and they're trying to pattern themselves after their own little union, like a United States, if you will, or a EU. They're trying to do that amongst themselves to form their own league and really get united in that way. So this is not good for them as well. So they're stepping up and talking about what they should do about Libya's unrest. It's been going on for 26 days now, and it is a bloody mess over there. Iran, predominantly a Persian country, they had their protest beginning on February 15th, and because it's such a censored, the media is so censored over there, you just don't really know what's going on, but you can certainly expect that the ruthless regime of the mullahs is having their way with the protesters over there and killing them. That's what is suspected about that. Saudi Arabia was supposed to have a day of rage yesterday. And what happened was Saudi Arabia had, the King Abdullah had come back about 2 weeks ago, and he said he's going to pump $37 billion into his economy to try to help with employment and things like that. So he started making preventative moves to try to prevent another major protest like that in Egypt and an overthrow. And then they sent out a bunch of police to strategic areas yesterday to try to prevent this day of rage, and it was successful. But the concerns is that Saudi Arabia is the number one producer of OPEC oil. And we are already experiencing, since all this Arab unrest, especially with what's going on in Libya, we're experiencing the price of oil has gone up about 30 bucks a barrel. Before this all began, it was closing at about 75 bucks a barrel. Now it's up to around 105 bucks a barrel. So this is all very volatile, very much of concern. And then we've got the reasons of concern about this is that you've got the Strait of Hormuz up there by the red circle I put up right up here. And that Strait of Hormuz is at its narrowest stretch, 21 miles. And through there travels about 30 to 35% of the world's oil. And then you have this concern over here, the Suez Canal, through which two Iranian warships passed through after Mubarak had stepped down. Also, you got about 5 to 10% of the world's oil travels through there into the markets. 8% of all seaborne commerce goes through there. And then lastly, you have the Gulf of Aden, right down here, through which those are the main areas through which the oil can get out through the world. So that's why we're of great concern here. There was concerns that if Saudi Arabia's day of rage would have amounted to something, and it still might, that the price of oil could go up to 150 bucks a barrel. And many of the economists are saying if that happened, the economic recovery that isn't really happening would be really sidelined. And even Alan Greenspan said when you hit $150 a barrel is when you just can't guess what's going to happen next to the economy. So it's a great concern. The interesting thing is that all these countries, Well, so it's a very unstable over there, and that is not good for Israel. Interestingly, all these countries, for the most part, are involved in end times Bible prophecies, and that's why I'm going to start to dovetail off and speak about that. Many of them are involved in Psalm 83. You have Hezbollah and Lebanon and the Hamas and the Palestinians, the Jordanians, Saudi Arabians, and Syrians are in there, and that's in Psalm 83. And then you have Ezekiel 38, where you've got Iran, and this is a consortia led by Russia. It involves Iran, Turkey, Ethiopia. You see some of the names up there of who's involved. Libya is involved. So, interestingly enough, many of the protests going on right now are also involved in the Magog invasion. So I'm going to be talking about those just briefly in a nutshell. Psalm 83 is an Arab confederacy, 10 populations that want to come together to destroy the nation of Israel. I'll be spending quite a bit of time teaching on that tonight. And their goal is to take over the Promised Land. Ezekiel 38 and 39 is nine different populations, a coalition of nine spearheaded by Russia that is coming to invade Israel, but not to take over the land in as much as they want to take over plunder and great spoil. They want to take over prosperity from Israel, their livelihood. Different motives, different populations. For our purposes tonight, this evening, I'm going to be talking about the Psalm 83, calling them the inner circle. They exist in that pentagon there, the colored area, their ancient names superimposed upon their present-day equivalents. You don't need to write all that down. I'll be showing you better charts on that shortly. And so from the other perspective, we're going to call the Ezekiel 38 and 39 invasion the outer ring, because they're outside of that pentagon where all the Psalm 83 countries are. You see the arrows pointing down there. They're all over the map over there. A huge invasion. And many people believe that these are one and the same events, that the Ezekiel 38 and 39 invasion of Israel, the Gog of Magog battle, they call it, is also the Psalm 83 war is incorporated in that. And I'll be telling you that argument and why I dispel that as I conclude tonight. But just so you know, we'll be talking about an inner circle and an outer ring of these two specific prophecies. So which one's next? Last year when I spoke here, I did a whole talk on which is the next Middle East news headline, Psalm 83 or Ezekiel 38. And I spent most of the time telling you why I didn't think Ezekiel 38 and 39 was prepared to happen. Well, tonight I'm going to spend more time telling you why I believe Psalm 83 is. So a little bit of a different shift on the focus. Ezekiel 38 and 39, we are given great description in 52 passages of that. And for some reason, I've got a little mishap here. Let me get over here. Okay. That should work. Okay, somehow those slides got messed up. Okay. So what we are told in Ezekiel 38, verses 8 through 13, that there's prerequisite conditions that Israel must exist in before this prophecy can even occur. Israel, we're told in verses 8 through 13, must be regathered from the nations in the latter years, brought back from the sword. Now, all three of those things appear to be ongoing and are being fulfilled. Israel has been coming out of the nation since 1948. It is the latter years. And they have been brought back from persecution. You know, the Edict of Expulsion I spoke about yesterday in 1492, the Holocaust, out from persecution, brought back from the sword. They must dwell in the midst or the center of the land, which has long been desolate. The Hebrew word for center is tabor, and it means right in the center of the land. And I don't believe Israel presently is dwelling in the center of the land that God gave to Abraham in Genesis 15:18, which was from the river of Egypt to the river of Nile. That would pretty much put Jordan more in the center. And I'll be telling you when Jordan surrenders sovereignty in Jeremiah 49 to Israel. And I believe that's after Psalm 83. I'll be telling you that, quoting that prophecy. Peaceful people dwelling securely, number 5. The Hebrew words are Yeshav Vatach. Is Israel dwelling securely? I don't believe so. They've been fighting war after war in 1948, 1967, 1973, intifadas, jihads, Hezbollah conflict, 34-day conflict in August of 2006, and the Operation Cast Lead, 22-day conflict with Hamas recently when Obama was inaugurated in January of 2009. And they are not dwelling securely in my estimation. So I'll breeze through that one and then telling you when they will dwell securely according to a prophecy. They must be dwelling without walls, bars, nor gates. Well, Israel does have a 403-mile wall being constructed down Israel, in Israel to keep Palestinian terrorism out from Israel proper. At some points, that's 20 feet high. At other points, it's a fence. And there are checkpoints throughout Israel. Are they dwelling without walls, bars, nor gates? If you look at that literally, I would say no. That's another prerequisite. Do they have gold and silver and acquired livestock and goods? Another prerequisite. The Hebrew word for acquired is asah. It doesn't mean developed, but it means acquired. So have they acquired livestock and goods and that sort of thing? I believe it's identifying an Israel that gets spoils of war. And then ultimately, that is what Russia is coming after. It says they're coming after a wealthy nation possessing great spoils, great plunder. So does that Israel exist today in totality? I do not believe so. Israel is not dwelling securely. We'll start right there. When will Israel be dwelling securely? You look back 10 chapters to Ezekiel 28. For some reason, the PowerPoint isn't working, which is problematic. While they're trying to fix it, turn to Ezekiel 28. And we're going to pick it up around verse 25. How are you doing there, Jonah? Okay, so Ezekiel 28, verses 25 through 27. If you want to know when Israel will dwell securely, you can find out right here. Thus says the Lord God, when I have gathered the house of Israel from the peoples among whom they are scattered and am hallowed in them in the sight of the Gentiles, then they will dwell in their own land, which I gave to my servant Jacob, and they will dwell safely, Yeshav Vatach, the same Hebrew words in Ezekiel 38. They will build houses and plant vineyards. Yes, they will dwell securely, Yeshav Vatach. When? When I execute judgment on all those around them who despise them. Then they shall know that I am the Lord their God. So, they will dwell safely when judgments are executed upon those around them who despise them. The Psalm 83 nations that I showed you in the inner circle on the map earlier, they are the nations around them. And do they despise them? Well, they've been fighting wars against them one after another. Do we think it's going?
Yeah.
Great, thank you. Okay, well, that was the passage you just read. I'm going to try to get through this. Okay, it's not working. This whole thing's kind of messed up. Sadly, let's see. Okay, here we go. Let's try this. So Psalm 83, the Arab-Israeli War. We're going to talk about that right now. If you want to turn to Psalm 83 in your Bibles, you can, but a lot of it's going to be on the screen if the screen works. Okay. Interestingly, the summer of 2006 turned out to be a very, very prophetic year. If you were watching events closely, an Irish engineer was digging through bog soil. He was excavating for a project, a major construction project over there, soggy bog soil in Ireland, and he discovered under his backhoe some antiquities and parchments that had been buried in the bog soil for quite some time. And it turns out that these were a lot of psalms that were written in Latin that had been buried there for approximately 800 to 1200 years. It was hailed as the Irish Dead Sea Scrolls find. It was quite amazing. A lot of those psalms are just beyond repair, and they've got them in the museum. They're trying to fix whatever they can, but they're really beyond repair, except one psalm, which was open in place, unblemished, not destroyed by the bulldozer. I mean, this was not an archaeological dig with toothbrushes. And guess what psalm that was? Psalm 83. Interestingly, the headlines were coming out. National Geographic said, medieval Christian book discovered in an Ireland bog. The Associated Press said, ancient book of Psalms found in Irish bog. But WorldNet Daily had a very interesting connecting news headline. Psalm in a bog linked to Israel's current war. Well, interestingly, you know, this was found on July 26. Interestingly, Israel was in a 34-day conflict that began on July 12th of that summer of 2006 with Hezbollah. Well, Hezbollah seems to be in Psalm 83, as does Israel. And I'll be showing you where they're located in there, of course. Now, this is quite... The New York Times, of course, came out with a headline that said Israel vowing to rout Hezbollah. CNN said Israel warplanes hit Beirut etc. So you had this interesting situation going. Two countries or populations fighting against each other in a psalm that's found intact, that shouldn't have been found. It should have been destroyed. How can that thing last 800 to 1,200 years? Coincidence or providence? I believe it was providence. There's 150 psalms. There's 1,189 chapters in the Bible. There's 31,173 verses in the Bible. Psalm 83 contains 18 passages, and it does talk about Hezbollah, most likely, and Israel. So the odds of that are really one in a couple dozen. I mean, you know. So meanwhile, during that same summer, I was writing a book called Israelistan, The Ancient Blueprints of the Future Middle East. And now it's working so good. There we go. And it discusses the, it's about Psalm 83 for the most part, and it's available to you out there in the foyer. Beginning with the prelude of what, the events leading up to Psalm 83, the event itself and in the aftermath, what the world looks like, the Middle East looks like, according to Bible prophecy. It has been read by several people at this point in time and endorsed by Jonathan Bernis, Jewish Voice, who says it's a must-read to understand Bible prophecy. Chuck Missler, a most important book for our times. A few more endorsements from Dr. David Reagan and Dr. David Hawking as well has read it. So I would invite you to get the book if you want to get much more detail about the events as they're shaping up over there with some biblical prophecy involved. Now let's talk about Psalm 83 at this point. 3,000 years ago, Asaph wrote this psalm. It was at a time when King David was reigning over the Jewish people. They were experiencing unprecedented blessings of the Abrahamic covenant. They were a people in their land with a king. They were prosperous. They were talking about building their temple to God. And Asaph comes out with this genocidal prophecy. And it says in Psalm 83, verses 1 through 5, "Do not keep silent, O God, do not hold your peace, and do not be still, O God, for behold, your enemies make a tumult, and those who hate you have lifted up their head. They have taken crafty counsel against your people and consulted together against your sheltered ones. They have said, 'Come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be remembered no more.' For they have consulted together with one consent. They form a confederacy against you." Well, let's look at that for a second here. It's talking about your enemies make a tumult and those who hate you have lifted up their head. Apparently, he's identifying two groups for us there. And I'll be telling you who I believe he's identifying for you on a future slide. They have taken crafty counsel against your people and consulted together against your sheltered ones. And they want to cut the nation of Israel off, that the name Israel be remembered no more. Well, this requires that an Israel exists if you're going to cut the nation off, that the name Israel be remembered no more. And Israel, of course, became a nation again in 1948. So unless it happened before Israel was dispersed in 70 AD when the Roman Empire conquered Jerusalem and destroyed the temple, when there was an Israel, it couldn't have happened during the 1878 years of worldwide dispersion. It had to happen from 1948 on. So did it happen? Has it happened? Time permitting, we'll discuss that as well. But it requires that an Israel must exist. And so here we are. Here's who they are. You have the tents of Edom and the Ishmaelites, Moab and the Hagarites, Hagarenes in some translations, which I prefer, Gebal, Ammon, and Amalek. Phoenicia with the inhabitants of Tyre. Assyria has also joined with them. They have helped the children of Lot. And in verse 12, we're told their motive, who said, "Let us take for ourselves the pastures of God, the promised land, for our possession." So here we're told who they are and what their goal is. They want to take over the promised land. They want another Arab state, if this applies today, and they want to call it Palestine, not Israel. I've highlighted in yellow who the enemies, who those who hate you group would be versus the your enemies that I told you about earlier. Tents of Edom, Ishmaelites, Moab, Hagarites or the Hagarenes, Ammon and Amalek. These are all people inside of this confederacy. They're patriarchs and or matriarchs in the case of Hagar. Coveted the contents of the Abrahamic covenant. They had familial relationships with Abraham, Isaac and Jacob and their descendants. And they became covetous of the Abrahamic covenant that was issued 4,000 years ago to Abraham through Isaac. Passes through Isaac, Jacob and the Jewish people. If you want to know more about where you can find about their feuds, the family feuds that took place, You had the matriarchs with Sarah versus Hagar. They would be the Hagarines. You can find that in Genesis 16 and 21. I get into this in my book as well, so you don't have to write all this down if you don't want. Just buy my book instead. The sons would be Ishmaelites, Isaac and Ishmael. The twin brothers would be Jacob and Esau. That would be the tents of Edom in Psalm 83. I'm going to show you how they connect with the Palestinians today shortly. The cousins would be the Israelites versus the Ammonites and Moabites. You see that they're in Numbers over there, 22 through 25. And the great-grandkids, the Amalekites. The great Amalek was a great-grandson of Abraham. The Hebrews versus the Amalekites. I believe we are being identified there that they are the group that hates the haters of Psalm 83. Here's who they are in a more understandable chart for you to look at. You've got the tents of Edom would be the Palestinians and the southern Jordanians, the Ishmaelites, the Saudis. Ishmael was the father of the Arabs. Moab, Palestinians and central Jordanians. Hagarines, Egyptians would be Hagar. She was the Egyptian matriarch who mothered Ishmael. Gebal would be up in Lebanon. Ammon would be the Palestinians and northern Jordanians. Amalek would be the Arabs of the Sinai. Philistia would be the Hamas of the Gaza. Tyre would be Hezbollah of southern Lebanese. And Assyria would be the Syrians and northern Iraqis. Now, if Asaph was alive today, and this prophecy is about to find fulfillment, he did not have these terms, Palestinians, Jordanians, in the vernacular of his time. So I'm sort of taking the liberty of telling you, I think he would be telling you he was trying to identify for us. Now, notice in the very top of the list, you have the tents of Edom. In the list, top of this category, they're listed in a condition of habitation. And tents of, biblically, either represent military encampments or refugee conditions. Whenever you see a member listed first in a confederacy, they tend to be the lead player in the confederacy. The star of the show, if you will, like the credits at the end of a movie. So we've got the tents of Edom, who I'm going to show you, I believe, would be the Palestinian refugees today, and I'll show you how they resulted that way. Okay, so that's who they are. This is where they are, listed by their ancient names. I showed you this Psalm 83 map earlier with their modern-day equivalents. Again, they are the nations and or terrorist populations that share common borders with Israel. That's where they are. They are those around Israel who despise Israel, the reason Israel cannot dwell securely, Yishav B'tach, until judgments are executed upon them. And I would take a moment to say that God does not delight in the destruction of the wicked. He does not delight in killing Arabs. But he does have foreign policy in place 4,000 years ago in Genesis 12, verses 2 and 3, where he said he would bless those who bless Abraham and carries on through his descendants, Isaac, Jacob, and the Jews. And he would curse those who oppress them on the flip side. And so that foreign policy is still intact, and Psalm 83 is definitely an attempt at cursing the Jews. They want to destroy the nation, that the name Israel will be remembered no more. So judgments will be executed upon them. So this is the promised land. This is where they are around them today. And they occupy all this land. Now it says in Genesis 15:18 there at the top that this describes for us what the true promised land is. And it was given to Abraham in Genesis 15:18, and it encompasses from the river of Egypt, which many of us would believe would be the Nile, all the way through over to the river Euphrates, over in here to Iraq. Now here's Israel today, about 8,009 square miles. They're not necessarily dwelling in the center of the land. Be kind of like in here, which would be Jordan. But that's where all these Psalm 83 populations are presently. And so when Israel, the haunting message that whenever Israel was in the land that always haunted the Arabs was, one, our God is the only God, according to Exodus 20, verse 2. Thou shalt have no other gods before him. The other message they gave was, Israel is the greatest nation. Because in Genesis 12, 2, God said to Abraham, I will make you a great nation. The Hebrew word is gadol. It means a massive, marvelous, mighty, and exceedingly prominent and prosperous nation. The nation above all nations. That was, of course, the Jewish promise, the Hebrew promise. Number three, you must bless us, Arabs, or you will be cursed. Genesis 12, 3. And fourth, the kicker, is that you are on our land. You are on our promised land. Well, obviously, the other Arabs, not the, those who hate you group, but the your enemies group of Psalm 83. They found it more favorable to embrace the adversarial attitudes against Israel incubated in the region from Hagar, Ishmael, and the Edomites, etc., rather than to support Israel. So they warred against Israel many times throughout their histories. And what was developed in the region was called, in the Bible, is called the ancient hatred or the perpetual enmity. The Hebrew words put together are Olam, Ibah. They show up two times in the Bible, and I'll be sharing those with you. And what they mean, if you translate it, is a perpetual enmity, a condition stemming back long ago in ancient times, perpetuated through time, manifesting into hostility with no apparent end in sight. In other words, it would continue to be bad for Israel. This attitude, according to the Bible, would continue on. So it must be judged, and Psalm 83 will come at the Jews, it appears, and they will be judged. And Israel will win, by the way, and I'll be going through, time permitting, those battles. Okay, so let's Tebow back and look at what happened in 1948. The Jews are legislated, the UN Resolution 181, they can come back into Israel. And immediately there was a war because the Arabs, who had achieved their statehood throughout the 1900s, they said to the Arabs of Palestine that were living there, get out, we need 5 days, we're going to destroy this Jewish state, there will be no Jewish state. And you can go back in and you can have it all. You can take over the neighborhoods and everything. We only need 5 days. I did a prophecy conference with General Shimon Arams this past September in Anaheim, who was involved in 1948, 1967, 1973 wars. He's retired now. He told me when this 1948 war happened, he said they had advanced fighter jets coming, bombing, and we had a few private planes, and we would open the cockpits and throw hand grenades out at strategic targets. Obviously, it was a God-ordained victory, as all the wars were subsequently in 67 and 73. So what happened in that instance is you created these refugees. There's a picture of them in 1949 in Jordan at the Bekaa refugee camp. You had the Palestinian refugees. I believe what you have here is the tents of Edom. The lead player, their plight, is what shows up in Psalm 83. So if you follow the migratory trails, and I have a whole book, a chapter in the book called the Hudamites, who are the Edomites today, you will find that there's ethnical representation within the Palestinians of the day, today, of the Edomites. And so that's who I believe Asaph was probably trying to identify for us. These refugees are all over the place in the Middle East. They're not just in the West Bank where the Fatah are. They're in the Gaza, the Hamas, or Palestinian refugees as well. And they're scattered throughout all those different places, throughout Jordan and Syria, where those little red dots are up there on the screen. And this is a real problem because the Arabs want the Palestinian refugees to have a right of return back into Israel, and Israel cannot allow that to happen. That's why it's going to be very difficult for peace to ever be achieved. That'll be a sticking point. So in essence, in summary, what do we have here in Psalm 83? They want to destroy the nation of Israel, that the name of Israel be remembered no more. There's who they are up on the right. There's the tents of Edom, the Palestinian refugees, and they want to take for themselves the promised land, and they want to call it Palestine. That's how I'm viewing this when I read this. That's how I believe this is translating for us. You can do your own homework on that. But what it boils down to, really, is the Arabs are standing behind the Palestinian plight, and you're facing Palestinianism and versus Zionism. You have two competing ideologies going on in the Middle East. One craves a Jewish state, believes it's a God-given right, and the other denies that right. Palestinianism is a term that was coined by Bat-Yor in her book Arabia in 2005, and it's Palestinian condenses jihadist values. It promotes the destruction of Israel, the denial of Hebrew biblical history, and hence Christianity. It preaches Islamic replacement theology and the Arabization and Islamization of the Holy Land's biblical archaeology. That is Islamic replacement theology. They don't want an Israel that exists versus Zionism, term pretty much coined by the movement of Theodor Herzl in 1896 when he wrote his book called Der Judenstaat, which means the Jewish state in German. He wrote this book at a time when they were trying to avoid increased anti-Semitism in Europe and some of the nations of the world. And his feeling was the only way to avoid that was to have a Jewish state. So, of course, World War I and World War II came since Theodor Herzl wrote that book. And Jewish plans were put on hold until 1948, of course, and the Holocaust happened, and so on and so forth. As Satan tried to prevent the return of the Jews into the land through a madman named Adolf Hitler. If you have a classic good versus evil going on when you're dealing with the Arab-Israeli conflict over there. There are enemies of God. There are haters of God. The patriarchs coveted the contents of the Abrahamic covenant. It has played out through the centuries. We're watching it unfold in living color before our eyes, in my estimation. The plan is to destroy the Jews because they were told, Abraham was told he would have descendants forever in Genesis 13, 15, and Genesis 22, 17. So they wanted to cut the nation Israel off, that the name Israel be remembered no more. And then in verse 12, they want to take the pastures of God for their possession. Well, they want to possess the promised land. Abraham was promised in Genesis 15, 18, as I just showed you, that he would have, to the descendants, he would give them all that land. So, destroy the Jews, take the land. What do? You prove the Lord is a promise breaker. That's the angelic conflict, kind of in a summarized nutshell. That's why the Jews are always got a bullseye on their back. I mean, they've been genocidal attempt after genocidal attempt. And Psalm 83 appears to be following that same pattern. So we're going to talk about reading further on through we're struggling here again, aren't we? Is this working? Bear with me. Okay. Good. All right. We're going to conclude with Psalm 83, and then I'm going to try to summarize a little bit for you. He goes on to say in Psalm 83, verses 9 through 12, deal with them as with Midian. Now, Asaph is petitioning God with how to deal with Psalm 83, the Confederacy. That wants to destroy the nation of Israel. Deal with them as with Midian, as with Sisera, as with Jabin at the brook Kishon, who perished at Endor, who became as refuse, and that's dung in the Hebrew, refuse on the earth. Make their nobles like Oreb and like Zeb, yes, all their princes like Zebah and Zalmunna, who said, let us take for ourselves the pastures of God for a possession. That's how we understand the motive. Asaph is identifying. This is the motive that the Midianites had. And Gideon, of course, fought them, and this is the motive that the Canaanites had when King Jabin was their king. Now, to understand these stories where Asaph is drawing for God to respond in a certain fashion, you have to go back through Judges chapters 4 through 8. And you're going to find in Judges chapters 6 through 8 that the Midianites had oppressed Israel, the Israelites, for 7 years. And God lifted up Gideon. You probably know the story. You can find it, like I said, in these Judges chapters. And he had 300 warriors who destroyed 105,000 Midianites. It was an empowered Israeli defense forces of that time, divinely empowered. So this is one thing to watch for right there. It was definitely had God's fingerprints all over that. And then the Midianites, by the way, you can't find, to my knowledge, any historical or biblical or archaeological proof that they ever oppressed Israel again after Gideon's victory. I think that's key when we're trying to understand if Psalm 83 has found fulfillment. The next one you would find in Judges, talking about Judges 4 and 5, when Deborah the prophetess had Barak. He had 10,000 men, and he went and he destroyed the King Jabin and his general. King Jabin was a Canaanite, king of Canaan, and Sisera was his general. They were destroyed. The Canaanites had oppressed Israel for 20 years, and they were destroyed. And they also ceased, the Canaanites, to ever oppress Israel further. So it was the end of that oppression. Now, when he talks about Oreb and Zeb, these were the princes of the Midianites. Gideon's men killed them. Zeb and Zalmunna were the Midianite kings. Gideon personally killed them. So I believe what we have here, the lesson here, is it's a total defeat. Top to bottom, kings, princes, ordinary soldiers against overwhelming odds, like Gideon's scenario. And that the IDF, I believe, exists in Bible prophecy, the Israeli Defense Forces today, for the very purpose of defeating the Psalm 83 Arab Confederacy. If you study the wars that are still to come against Israel, Ezekiel 38 and 39, and the Armageddon campaign, subsequently led by the Antichrist, the Israeli Defense Forces really do play little to no part in those. Ezekiel 38 and 39 comes, and God stops that. We're told that in Ezekiel 38, verses 16 through Ezekiel 39, verses 6. The Armageddon campaign, ultimately, there's a Jewish remnant that recognizes Jesus as the Messiah and beckons his return, and he destroys the Antichrist and the armies of the world. So the Israeli Defense Forces really seem to exist today to fulfill one purpose, and I will be going over that now. Ezekiel 37:10 tells us that Israel will come out of the Holocaust and then become an exceedingly great army. Okay, it says in this chapter, "So I prophesied as he commanded me, and breath came into them, and they lived and stood upon their feet, an exceedingly great army." That's in Ezekiel 37:10. And I'm not getting it to work, but I'm trying. There we go. Okay. So the Israeli Defense Forces were prophesied to come. And I could do a whole study on that, but the Hebrew word for the exceedingly great army is Shael. And Ezekiel uses it 12 times in his chapters. And it literally talks about an army or the spoils of war taken by an army. And the reason I tell you that is there is a translation out there, I think it's the New Revised Standard, that says it's a vast multitude versus an exceedingly great army. But clearly Ezekiel is intending to tell us it's an exceedingly great army. And he uses the word 12 times throughout his prophetic book. So what is the prognosis? Let's start with the Palestinians. I believe we can find that in Obadiah, chapter 1, verse 18. "The house of Jacob shall be of fire, and the house of Joseph of flame." Read that as Israel. "But the house of Esau shall be stubble. They shall kindle them and devour them, and no survivor shall remain in the house of Esau, for the Lord has spoken." Remember, God is going to judge those around Israel who despise them. It appears as though he's going to do them in like for like kind. In other words, they want to destroy the Jews militarily, so that it looks like militarily the Jews will destroy them, conversely. So you can read that yourself. I believe that's what we're being identified there. The tents of Edom, the Palestinian refugees, are going to experience a very bad situation there. Okay, now we're going to go over to talk about the Saudi Arabia. Yes, okay. I think it's this one. Okay. "Therefore, thus says the Lord God, I will also stretch out my hand against Edom and cut off man and beast from it and make it desolate from Teman. Dedan," which would be Saudi Arabia, "shall fall by the sword." Now, Dedan would be, by association, Saudi Arabia, the Ishmaelites, in Psalm 83, verses 6 through 8. "I will lay my vengeance on Edom by who? By the hand of my people Israel." The IDF, I believe. "That they may do in Edom according to my anger and according to my fury, and they shall know my vengeance, says the Lord God." Okay, let's talk about the Hamas. They are the democratically elected leadership of Israel, of the Palestinians. I'm sorry, I'm watching my time here. This PowerPoint is slowing me down here. They became elected in January of 2006. They are a political arm of the Muslim Brotherhood, founded in 1987. They came up with their charter in 1988. These are some of the tenets of their charter. These are the people the Palestinians voted in as their leadership in January. "Israel will exist and continue to exist until Islam will obliterate it. The land of Palestine is also to be Islamic, consecrated to future Muslim generations. And there is only one way to resolve the conflict, and that is not through politically brokered peace deals, but through jihad." Now, this is still part of their charter. Okay? So what's going to happen with them? Now, by the way, they have fired 6,300 rockets into Israel, and that's what created the need to have that Operation Cast-Lead battle in December of 2009 that carried over into January of 2008. That would be 1,575 a year from the time they started doing that, 131 a month, 5 per day. Now, Hezbollah, to the north, has 60,000 rockets in violation of UN Resolution 1701. In 2006, they were told to dismantle their arsenal after the 34-day conflict. Now they have 60,000 rockets. By Benjamin Netanyahu's admission last year, he believes they have 60,000 rockets. That means they've been producing them in the last 4.5 years at 13,000, or getting them, acquiring them, at a rate of 13,333 rockets a year, 1,111 per month, and 36.5 per day. They're still getting rockets. What are they going to do with those? Hassan Nasrallah says that he can now destroy half of Israel's army, and there is no target safe in Israel, no place safe in Israel. So let's talk about Hamas. They are where the Philistines would be. Philistia, ancient Philistia in Psalm 83. So let's see what we got there. We got Ezekiel 25, verses 15 through 17. Thus says the Lord God, because the Philistines dealt vengefully and took vengeance with a spiteful heart to destroy because of the old hatred. I told you about that Olami Ba. Therefore, thus says the Lord God, I will stretch out my hand against the Philistines and I will cut off the Sherethites and I will execute vengeance with furious rebukes, and they shall know that I am the Lord when I lay my vengeance upon them. Very similar type thing in Ezekiel 25 that was dealt with Edom and dealt with the Dedan of Saudi Arabia. Okay, now, here's one that we're all watching pretty closely, and it's the destruction of Damascus in Isaiah 17, dealing with Syria. Okay, it says in Isaiah 17, the burden against Damascus. Behold, Damascus will cease from being a city, and it will be a ruinous heap. We're told in verse 9, in that day his strong cities will be as a forsaken bough and an uppermost branch, which they left because of the children of Israel, and there will be desolation. And then verse 14, we're told, and behold, at eventide, trouble, and before the morning he is no more. This is the portion of those who plunder us, and the lot of those who rob us. So, unfortunately, I'm running out of time, and I have got a whole lot more to go over, so I'm going to really summarize in a nutshell here for you. Let's talk about Syria for a second here. Okay, now this thing's working again, see? Because I do want to talk about this one. But before we do, let's go over Syria. Syria is the oldest continuously inhabited history in recorded history. It dates back 4,000 years to the time of Abraham. It is the capital of Syria. Approximately 4 to 5 million people live in or around the metropolitan areas. The destruction of Damascus, it'll cease to be a city, it'll be a ruinous heap, will be a major world-changing event. And refugees will flood the deserts of northern Jordan and northern Iraq. And the Arab League will meet, because Syria is a member of the Arab League. This will be a big deal. It does not appear to have found any final fulfillment as of yet. We're watching this closely. I read to you verse 14. Then behold, at eventime, trouble, and before the morning, he is no more. This is the portion of those who plunder us and the lot of those who rob us. It's very possible that one evening at eventide, you see Syria. It exists. Just like Japan, one evening was in great shape, and then one morning an earthquake comes and devastates a lot of it. But the next morning, it ceases to exist. And he says, this is the portion of those who plunder us and the lot of those who rob us. Syria, through the banner of Assyria, seems to be involved in Psalm 83 as well. Okay, let's talk about Jordan real quickly. And this is where I believe Jordan surrenders sovereignty to Israel. Therefore, behold, the days are coming. This is in Jeremiah 49, 1 and 2. Says the Lord, that I will cause to be heard an alarm of war in Rabbah of the Ammonites. It shall be a desolate mound. Sounds very much like it's what's happened to Syria, is Damascus. And her villages shall be burned with fire. Then Israel shall take possession of his inheritance, says the Lord. Remember, Jordan is part of that, exists inside of that Genesis 15, 18 landmass from the river of Egypt to the river Euphrates. This appears to be when Jordan surrenders sovereignty. And it is an alarm of war that is heard, and it becomes a desolate mound as a result. Rabbah of the Ammonites would be very comparable to where Amman, Jordan is today. That is the capital of Jordan. So I believe we're being told here for Jordan's participation as Moab and the Ammonites in Psalm 83. They will be defeated. Israel will lash out, the Israeli defense forces, and Amman, Jordan will be a desolate mound. Very possible. When else did that find fulfillment? When else will that find fulfillment? Okay. Then, let's see if I can get this one to work. Let's talk about Egypt. There we go. In that day, Egypt, this is in Isaiah 19, verses 16 through 18. In Egypt, under the banner of the Hagarenes, is probably also involved in Psalm 83. In that day, Egypt will be like a woman and will be afraid and fear because of the waving of the hand of the Lord of hosts, which he waves over it. And the land of Judah will be a terror to Egypt. Everyone who makes mention of it will be afraid in himself because of the counsel of the Lord of hosts, which he has determined against it. And in that day, five cities in the land of Egypt will speak the language of Canaan and swear by the Lord of hosts, one will be called the city of destruction. The language of Canaan is Hebrew. So what we have here is Egypt, and I believe that this fear that is being spoken of has been growing in Egypt since 1948 wars and 1967 wars. They will be afraid, and this fear will ultimately become a whole terrorizing feeling over Egypt. And I believe that's when they get involved with Psalm 83. They see that Israel is going to respond decisively. And ultimately, they are destroyed, they're defeated, and five cities end up speaking the language of Canaan, suggesting that Jews move over into probably northeastern Egypt, east of the Nile, because remember in Genesis 15, 18, they're given from the river of Egypt to the river Euphrates. So perhaps five cities will spring up in the aftermath of Psalm 83. That's where I'm putting it, but, I don't know. But then let's conclude and talk about Israel. What's Israel's fate? We're told in Ezekiel 36, verses 8 through 10, "But you, O mountains of Israel, you shall shoot forth your branches and yield your fruit to my people Israel, for they are about to come. For indeed I am for you, and I will turn to you, and you shall be tilled and sown. I will multiply men upon you, all the house of Israel, all of it, and the city shall be inhabited and the ruins rebuilt." And that is what's going on in Israel today. The Jerusalem Post announced that tourism for 2010 was at a record level. It increased 26% from the year before in 2009. On October 20th of 2011, October 20th of last year, Fox News' Bill Hemmer did a special. He said that real estate was booming in Israel. High-rise condos were being built were costing $20 million. Jerusalem values were up 20% that year, he said. His specialist had said the new apartments in Jerusalem were going out at $1 million. A 1,000-square-foot existing apartment in Jerusalem was at $600,000. I remember the average income in Israel is $30,000. So who can afford this stuff? Who's buying these? Okay. So the good news is that Israel wins, but it's hard to say if they're going to experience some issues in the war. And I'm actually writing a book on that. And so I'll let you know when that comes out. But I have been given the plug. I've got to go. And I'm sorry I didn't get through all the slides, but technical difficulties prevented that. So I want to thank you very much for your time. And if I were you, I would keep your eye on what's going on in the Middle East.